Welcome to the Scholarship of CBPR session. It's nice to see old friends. Today we actually have a pretty full-on schedule with lots of wonderful presentations. So the way that I'm going to do things is time presentations for 12 minutes for everybody, and then we'll do the question and answer at the end of the session. But my name is Jim Amell, former Kellogg Health Scholar from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Currently assistant professor at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado. Speakers are just reminded to acknowledge if there are any financial disclosures. So we're going to start with Dr. Shalon Irving, who is going to be presenting to us on How Did We Get Here? The Hashima Project, Study of Adolescent Life.
Thank you. Start my timer. Okay, good morning. I did this project as a Morgan State Scholar in the Kellogg Health Program. My partners are Reverend Deborah Hickman, and she sends her regrets for not being able to be here. She had competing demands. I'm at Dr. Anita Hawkins at Morgan State. And just briefly, I know I'm on the clock, but I did start out, I'll tell you that in a second. Okay, I know we're supposed to do this first. So I have no financial relationships to disclose. Okay, so how was I supposed to read the whole thing? I have to read the whole thing. Okay. I titled the project "How Did We Get Here?" because it was an interesting project, as CBPR, community-based participatory research, always is. And often I'd be sitting in a session or halfway through an event and figuring out how did we get here? How did this conversation begin? How did we get to where we're at? And so I have a picture of a pathway and kind of our path to the project and where we ended up. So I'll briefly describe my partner and talk about the development of the project, how we got to our question, and then where we went from there. Oops, that would help. My partnership was with Sisters Together and Reaching Our Star. It's a community-based HIV prevention organization in Baltimore City. They celebrated their 20th anniversary this year. Their mission is to provide spiritual support, direct services, and prevention education to HIV and AIDS infected and affected and at-risk communities in a holistic woman and man-centered way, and recently started to incorporate more and focus on youth and the family. STAR has served over 25,000 individuals in their 20 years of existence and has a long history of working with the health empowerment conferences in Baltimore and the drawing attendees from as far away as, I think the last one was either Colorado or Utah, because I usually do the evaluations. In 2011, we got them all the way from out west. And in 2010, started to do the youth conference as well as other youth initiatives, rap sessions, and girls talks at local communities and high schools. So the birth of a CBPR project. Getting to how we got here. My partnership with STAR was formed in 2009. We got together in the beginning and talked about the community needs as they saw them. We brought in information from the community and asked people, what do you need? I also did the evaluations of the youth and the adults at the Sex Lies and the Ugly Truth conference in 2010. And from that, we learned that about 90% of girls were saying, we need more support. And 100% of the mothers and the adults that were in the audience said, we want to support our kids and our youth that are in our circles, but they weren't really sure how. And clearly, if everybody wanted it and everybody wanted to give it, there had to be some kind of disjuncture. So we started to figure out what's going on. And so the Hashima Project, which is Swahili for respect, was developed based on those findings as well as other identified needs and conversations. And we presented the project back to the staff and to our youth educators and community members. And one thing I think was just really important in terms of kind of vetting our questions as researchers, I had a question that I thought sounded so perfectly normal, and it made sense to me. The question was, since you began having sex, has there ever been a period of 3 months or more where you stopped, having sex? And that, you'd think you could be able to answer that question. The kids were like, they were so confused. And so they thought that I was asking if someone had a menstrual cycle for 3 months or more, a period of for 3 months after sex. And they're like, oh, no, that sounds horrible. And I'm just like, and again, how did we get here? I'm like, how did you get to that logic from that? But so we changed the question. but it was an interesting process. So how did we get here? Like I said, the question that we really began with, the heart of the question, is what's going on with our girls? We know that African American teenagers, even though the teen birth rates are decreasing for all groups, African American teenagers and Hispanic young women have the highest teen pregnancy rates, they have higher rates of sexually transmitted disease and HIV infection rates and what's going on. It can't just be, you know, it has to be more than what we're thinking because what we're doing isn't always working. So, you know, where are we and how can we help them move from there? We had a lot of goals, and what I'm going to focus on today is looking at information about their family dynamics and trying to figure out, is it something that's going on in the family? Is it something that you're missing? Is it something that you're getting that too much of? As well as looking at their intergenerational support. We know you have friends. We see you out with your friends all the time, but do you have parents that are talking to you? Do you have grandparents and in-laws? We know that in the past in African American communities, fictive kin or just extended family has been something that's been very important. And are those relationships still in existence? Do people still utilize and call on those support networks? So we started to look at those things. Whew, okay. Briefly, we did a mixed method project. So we did have a quantitative survey with 157 respondents, and there's some information about that. I'm going to focus today on the Photo Voice project, and voices in capitals for a reason, because it really did become more about their talking than about the pictures. And I wasn't expecting that. How did we get here? We ended up with 5 girls in the that were drawn from the quantitative study. Using the photo discussion prompt, which I will say didn't actually end up working out with this population. They just wanted to talk. They didn't need any prompts. They needed no prompting. Sometimes we're trying to figure out how do you make them stop. Is there an off switch? but there's not in teenagers, as I found out. My mother tried to tell me that. I didn't trust her. We analyzed session recordings from 5 sessions, about 10 hours of recordings, and conducted selective coding. These are the questions that the girls went out and answered through their photos each week. And again, today we're going to talk a little bit about the number 2 and 3, the individual, you know, what's it like being young and African American and female in this society and today? And what makes you happy or sad about your family? Okay. Some of the themes that emerged, and there were quite a few. But one thing, and this wasn't, and I was going to just talk about the family dynamics, but at the same time that I was talking about family dynamics and preparing the presentation, this issue of not being seen, not being heard, just kept coming out, and it was distinct from the family, because it wasn't just my mom doesn't understand me, which is what we all hear and we all have said, but it was more than that. And they expressed feelings ranging from sadness to anger and frustration at not being seen. And I just have a couple of quotes here. And one girl, and this was without provocation, I can't even remember what the topic for the day was, but it wasn't that. And she just started talking about the fact that nobody listens to her, her mom doesn't listen to her, and she's just so just anxious to get her story out that she'll tell it to a stranger. And someone came, her mother ended up marrying into the Muslim faith, and someone came down to perform the wedding. And she said the man came in and he was just somebody that was involved in the wedding, and she just started telling him her story. And before she even knew his name, she didn't find out his name till later, but she's like, if nobody wants to hear me, then what's the purpose of me being here? And she just needed to get her story out. And it's also with moms, of course, and if we could talk more, if we could do stuff, that would be a good thing. They just want to be heard. And these feelings of invisibility are not without consequence. They make, it prompts behavior. And one girl, and it's funny because everybody asked her, well, what grade are you in? She said, in my middle school years, and she, I think, was in 10th grade at the time, I always did stuff to make myself seen, known. I wanted to be seen. I did a lot of dumb stuff. And so not that that's the only reason why teenagers engage in stuff, but they have reasons. They're not without rational. I mean, even though we think sometimes looking at them, that's not logical, you're not rational, but they are doing things that make sense to them. Relationship with mothers, and I'll just go through the bullets or the high... the topics areas, I guess. The relationship with the mother was the most salient relationship that we saw. No matter what the topic was, no matter what the conversation was about, somehow, some way, mom came into the picture. And they would come in, Dr. Shalon, let me tell you what my mom did this week. Let me tell you what happened. And like, this would be the beginning of almost every conversation. And these relationships were characterized by they loved their moms and they wanted that love, and it was clear that their mothers loved them. It's just sometimes that love wasn't meeting up. It was the tangible support they were doing for them. And the mothers think, I'm working 2 jobs. I'm doing all this stuff. I'm making sure that I get up early in the morning to bring them to programs like yours. But they didn't have time just to sit and listen because they were busy. But the kids hear that and feel, mommy doesn't love me. You know, if she would just stop working so much. But it's a necessary evil. And so those there was positive in those relationships, but there was a lot of negative that the girls perceived too. I would trade everything in the world just to get my mother's love, we heard often. Again, they perceived their mother's communication strategies as ineffectual. They wanted mothers to listen. They don't want to hear, when I was younger, this happened. They don't want to hear you tell them, don't do it. One girl said, I know I'm going to go through some things. I know I'm going to do some things wrong. Let me do them and be there to support me when I do those things wrong and help me to figure out where, you know, how to do better. Or let me figure it out myself and just love me through it. And they wanted mothers and not friends. And so often I think parents, especially in this generation, are trying to play to their kids. They're trying to be friends with their kids. They want to connect with them. But they're saying, we have friends. We need our moms to be mothers. This is what we need. And that, to me, was so interesting. Because intuitively I'm thinking that, you know, they're trying to connect. They're being hip. They're being cool. They're like, no, I want my mom. There's time for friends. But at the end of the day, I need my mom. Other relationships with family and friends were also important, especially with their siblings. They talked about that a lot. And even though they had these relationships, the mother, the family was still important. When push comes to shove, your friends are going to be there more than your family, which shows that for them, friends do become very salient because family is oftentimes unpredictable or not helpful. But at the end of the day, I still need my mom. And the one thing that was, again, surprising, that even through everything they were going through, even through some of the stories we heard, there's hope. They all, every one of them, had some way to think about how they were going to get through it. They, you know, my point of view is that I can do more. If I can do more, I'm not going to settle for less. You know, going to school for some of them was a way to get away from the family chaos. It's their mini vacation time. And for others, it was a dark place, and graduation was going to be their sunshine. Once they got out, once they got finished, then their life would begin. Then they'd be okay. So the unexpected, I'm almost done, coming to the home stretch. The photographs became secondary to the dialogue, and with photo voice, and I didn't have a lot of time to talk about it, but with photo voice, we think that the pictures are going to help people take, you know, to express themselves, but these girls didn't need help. The pictures were really great, and they gave us some cool things to have on the presentation. They loved doing it and loved showing it, but they came in talking. They just wanted someone to listen. They were so ready to get it out, and so it really did become secondary, and they were thoughtful and critical about their life circumstances. They knew what was happening. They knew why they felt the way they did. They didn't always know how to get from that place, but they understood where they were at. But they didn't have, I guess, the abstract thinking. So we were saying, you know, so most of the pictures became like, it became more of a self-portrait project. They wanted to be in every picture. But what was interesting is that even though they were going through such inner turmoil and angst, almost every picture you see them smiling and laughing. And I think that they had a hard time because they're so used to putting up this hard veneer and this act that everything's okay, I'm tough, I'm a survivor, that they weren't even able to let that go in pictures, even though they're coming in and saying, I took this in the bathroom after my mom yelled at me and denied me dinner because I wouldn't wash the dishes. But they're still smiling. And so it shows their resilience. I'm tearing up. Okay. Again, they spoke freely, often unprompted, and with extension. And they did form friendships and relationships in the group. Again, the relationship with mother was the most salient, but they really did understand the complexities of their family dynamics. Where we're going, we got some other stuff to do. We want to go back and do some more work with the intergenerational study to talk to their support networks and then to present their information back to the community and let the girls exhibit what they've done. And just last thing, the girls are all in school still, which is good because one at least was in an alternative school at the time. There were some issues. One is in an inpatient facility, but she kept going in and out. Her mother used that as a kind of form of like a babysitter. If you're acting up, I don't want to deal with you. So she took her and dropped her off in a facility. But three of the four girls who were in high school have maintained a positive mentoring relationship that we got them into through the program they asked to get into. So many special thanks to all my Kellogg people and the people that helped with the project. And that is the end of the Hashima project for now. Thank you so much.